Tonight's subject, the eye of their God was upon them.
Well, brothers and sisters, we got to the end of Ezra chapter 4 in our last session, only by some very rapid footwork towards the end of our last class. And the final point that we made in our class a fortnight ago, you may recall, was that it was remarkable that in a period of half a century, Yahweh had provided friendly rulers upon the throne of Persia, and yet for a short period of 7 months he permitted a king to reign upon the throne of Persia, an impostor by the name of Gamates, who was the one who issued the decree for the stopping of the building of the house of God. We made the point, brethren and sisters, that if Yahweh could do that, if for 49 and a half years he could provide friendly rulers, but only for 6 months allow that to happen, that the work might be stopped, it ought to have been palpably obvious to all those who were building in that house that it was a test of their faith. But they didn't see it. They didn't see that the hand of God was in their affairs at that stage. Tonight we want to consider how the hand of God came to be seen by them. And the eye of their God was upon them in a very real way, as we shall see this evening. And he worked in their midst, both by visible means through the prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, by their prophecy and by their example, and by invisible means through the angels whom he sent to supervise that work and to ensure that it prospered in their hand. Brethren and sisters, I don't think I need to make the point that we are living in a time when the hand of God is almost visible in the things that we are seeing going on in our world today, especially in Europe and in Russia. It's quite clear, is it not, that our brethren, the angels, who are committed with the task of shaping the affairs of nations to bring to pass the divine purpose, are busily at work right at this very moment of time. While you and I are taking some respite from our daily labours, they are continuing to labour on. And they will labour furiously until we take over from them, till the time comes when we will be taken by them into the presence of our Lord. And tonight we want to try and endeavour to do what we must try and do every day of our lives, and that is touch the realities of the invisible. Sounds strange, doesn't it? But we need to be able to reach out and touch the reality of the invisible. The fact, brethren and sisters, that from the very day that we committed ourselves to our God in a covenant, he sent an angel to supervise and to superintend our affairs and our life, who is a minister unto those of us who are heirs of salvation. And every single one of us has an angel who does that work every day. And if we fail to be in the kingdom, brethren and sisters, if we're not part of that spiritual house, it may be because we have not seen the invisible. We've not seen the eye of our God overshadowing our affairs. So really tonight there are two basic lessons in our study. One is a negative lesson, the other one's a positive lesson. The positive we've just mentioned. The negative, brethren and sisters, is what happened in that two-year interval between the stopping of the work and it restarting again, as is recorded in the first two verses of Ezra chapter 5. For in that 2 years, the nation was afflicted by the scourge of self-justification. And I hardly need to say again that the scourge of the modern brotherhood of Christ is the same disease. The disease of self-justification. And we are masterful, are we not? Some of us perhaps better than others, but we are masterful because of the deceitfulness of our nature at justifying ourselves and rationalising away our behaviour. We can make the most ludicrous of decisions as far as the truth is concerned and the best interests of eternal life are concerned, and yet we can justify them. Isn't it true? And of course, in the particular matter that we will consider tonight, Israel were able to justify the behaviour that is the bane of ecclesial life today. Materialism. The pursuit of self-interest and a disregard for the work of building in the house of God as a result of our interest in our own things. So they're the two lessons we want to cover this evening. And we're going to try and cover Ezra chapter 5 and 6. Sounds a tall order, but we'll endeavour to get through those two chapters. But just briefly, so that we might have the chronology firmly fixed in our minds, I'd like to put up this transparency again, which covers that area, Ezra 4 and Ezra 5 and 6. We reached this point here in our last study, you might remember, the year 522, which was the year of the assumption of power of the usurper, the pseudo-Smerdis, otherwise known in history as Gemates. He was only there for 7 months. The empire was racked with revolt. There were many who challenged his right to the throne. Amongst them, of course, was a rightful heir named Darius Hystaspes. And there were 8 other pretenders to the throne, whom Darius ultimately had to overcome. It took him about 2 years to consolidate his power. But it was in that confusion, in that period of time of 7 months, and then the confusion that followed it, that we have the history of Ezra chapter 5 unfolding. It wasn't until the second year of Darius Hystaspes that things had settled down and the decree of Cyrus could be confirmed, as we read in chapter, or at least we read the start of that process in chapter 5 this evening, and we're going to see the completion of that in chapter 6, God willing. Now Ezra 4 brings us up, as I said, to this year 522. Ezra chapter 5 and chapter 6 begins with the year 520, or the second year of Darius. Now you pick this up from the last couple of verses of chapter 4. In verse 23 we read that the copy of the letter that King Artaxerxes wrote was read before the Samaritans, and they forced the Jews to stop work by force and power. Now the Artaxerxes of verse 23 is the same Artaxerxes as we read of in verse 7. Those of you who have had the notes and have been doing a bit of work on it, you'll know immediately that the Artaxerxes of verse 7 is this usurper of the throne, Gemates. Alright, so it's the same Artaxerxes that's referred to in verse 23. The man who ruled for 7 months. So by his decree the work was stopped. And then the last verse tells us, then ceased the work of the sons of God, of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And from here on, the Darius referred to in the record is Darius Hystaspes, who ruled for some 36 years thereafter. He came to power late in the year 522 or early 521. His second year, therefore, is the year 520 BC. It was in that year that the work of the house of God began again. So you see, it had lain idle for 2 years. Ezra 5 and 6 is all about this period of 4.5 years, in fact just a fraction over 4.5 years, through to the first month of 515 BC, when they held the Passover after completing the temple in the 12th month of 516 BC. So for about 4.5 years that work went on, from the second year of Darius until the year 516, and then they held the Passover in the first month of 515. So that's where Ezra 5 and 6 comes in the chronology of this book. But brethren and sisters, something is missing. We are told absolutely nothing in the book of Ezra about this 2 years here between 522 BC and 520. The record is absolutely silent except for saying, then ceased the work. It doesn't tell us what the Jews were doing. It gives us no indication as to why they didn't get back to the work. It doesn't tell us anything about their preoccupations or their problems or their prosperity or otherwise. It just is absolutely silent. And if it wasn't for the prophecies of Haggai in particular and also Zechariah, we would know nothing about that 2 years. Tonight we want to just have a brief look, just to pull the curtain away. It's well-known territory, by the way, but we'll just pull the curtain aside again to have a look at what was going on in that 2 years, to see if we can extract some of the lessons that are there for ourselves in this modern age, when the problems are no different. In fact, they are identical. And all of us have got to think carefully about where we stand in relation to this matter. Now, just briefly, before we press on, I'd like to give you a brief summary of the content of Ezra 5 and 6. This is, you can pick this up from the notes that we're handing out anyway, but I'd just like to set this out so that you can see that it's not an impossible task to get through these two chapters. Verses 1 and 2 of chapter 5 speak of Haggai and Zechariah prophesying and the work of building recommencing from the year 520. Verses 3 to 5 sees the opposition arise again, and this time a letter is sent by the opposition, which appears this time to be rather the Persian authorities, whereas last time it was the Samaritan authorities, or at least the Samaritan peoples. Now it appears to be the Persian authorities that make this appeal to the king in the form of a letter. That letter is contained, as Anthony read from verse 6 to verse 17 of chapter 5. The content of that letter is spelled out for us. We won't have to spend much time on that. There's just one or two points we want to refer to, because it's fairly plain. It's just a description of what they were told by the Jews when they challenged them. In Ezra chapter 6, verses 1 to 12 deal with the letter or response that was sent by Darius Hystaspes to the letter that he received from the governor on the other side of the river. And he confirms the decree of Cyrus in those first 12 verses of Ezra chapter 6. He takes it a bit further, in fact. He makes the bold statement that if anybody opposed this work, then he would have the treatment that was later on handed out to Haman. He was hanged upon a tree, or upon a scaffold, and his house was made a dunghill. That's verse 11 of Ezra chapter 6. And then in verses 13 through to verse 15, we have the temple finished in the year 516 BC in the 12th month. Verses 16 to 18 record the dedication of the temple and the great rejoicing of the people as they made their offerings and the worship of the house of God was set in order. And then we have in the last few verses of chapter 6, in verses 19 to 22, the keeping of the Passover in the first month of the year 515 BC. Now the content of those two chapters is therefore not great in terms of necessity for verse-by-verse exposition. We'll just isolate the things that need to be talked about and the lessons that we want to make from those things. Now, this 2 years that we've described here between 522 and 520 was the period in Israel's history after they came back from Babylon when every man did right in his own eyes. Now, in making that statement, and I think all of you realise that I'm quoting the last verse of the book of Judges, Judges 21, verse 25, I want to make this point about it, brothers and sisters, without going back to that chapter in Judges, you know the statement well, that it does not mean that every man did his own thing. The statement that every man did that which was right in his own eyes doesn't mean, in the modern parlance, that every man went out and did his own thing. That's not what it's about. And the indices of the book of Judges, that is the last four or five chapters of that book, which really describe the character of the times of the judges, and in fact are placed chronologically right back in chapter 2 of Judges, between verses 9 and 10. Those indices spell out what the problem was in the days of the judges. It was, brethren and sisters, that some remarkable things were being done in the brotherhood of Christ, which were a cause of great tribulation for the brotherhood, and which led them ultimately into every form of idolatry. But that those who were responsible for that were capable of justifying what they did. And you should perhaps, as a matter of course, when treating of that statement that every man did that which was right, cross out the words in italics. The statement is made twice in those indices. Cross out the word in italics, the words in italics, and you'll have the correct translation. It should read that every man did right in his own eyes. That's the sense of it. Every brother and sister in those days did right as far as they were concerned in their own eyes. And no one could tell them that their behaviour was wrong. And there were some who tried. There were many who rose up and said, "This is the way, and walk, therefore walk ye in it." And they would say, "Brother, you don't know what you're talking about. What I'm doing is absolutely right." And you know what? The one thing that worries me about myself and about what I see and hear of others, brethren and sisters, is that the longer time goes on in this 20th century, the better we are becoming at declaring that what we do, which we may well suspect is not 100% correct, we are capable of justifying. We can rationalise it away and say, well, you know, it's not quite as bad as it may appear to be. And after all, other brethren are doing it. And we can get away with behaviour which 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years ago would have been outrightly condemned. But it's happening today, isn't it? It is the age of self-justification. Every man did right in his own eyes. And if you'd heard some of the things that I've heard in recent times, your hair would be as grey as mine. We are extremely capable of justifying the most heinous of crimes that Yahweh would condemn outright. Now that's the problem that we address in these 2 years. Let's have a look at what happened in those 2 years. Well, to do that we need, brethren and sisters, to go along to the book of Haggai. As I said, Ezra is silent, but Haggai is not. This is what happened to Israel in the time when the work of the house of God ceased. We read in the first verse of Haggai, it was the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, that the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet came to Zerubbabel and to Joshua, saying, look at the first words that Yahweh speaks to this people. It's been silent for some time. Thus speaketh Yahweh of armies, the militant title. You see, he's got something to say to these people that's not going to be very comfortable. And it's a warning and a challenge. This people say, the time has not come, the time that Yahweh's house should be built. Now, why were they saying that? Well, we need to have a look at the broader chronology of the times. I think by now you've got used to that previous transparency. This one really is an expansion of that, and you'll notice that this area here is the area that we have expanded on this other one. Alright, from 536 down to 516. The green represents the active work of building the house. It paused for 2 years here. Let's have a look at the overall chronology of the times, and we'll see why it was that this people were saying, in self-justification for what they were doing, that the time had not come to build Yahweh's house. Well, you see, they knew the prophecies of Jeremiah 25, verses 11 and 12, as well as you and I know them. They were very recent prophecies. And Jeremiah had spelled out, brethren and sisters, that there would be two periods of 70 years. There would be 70 years of desolation and 70 years of captivity. And they are not corresponding periods, not exactly corresponding. They begin and end at different times. And they were right in what they said. But they were using the scripture to justify their own inactivity in building the house of God and their blatant materialism. They were justifying themselves using the Bible. Now that, brethren and sisters, is the most brilliant form of deceit that the human heart can devise. You will never get any more brilliant deceit than that. To use the scripture to justify your own evil behaviour. That's what they were doing. You see, when Jeremiah said there would be 70 years captivity, the captivity of Judah began in the first invasion of Nebuchadnezzar in the year 606 BC. Minus 70 brings you down to 536 BC. And that's when they came back. Cyrus issued his decree and 40 odd thousand came back. They began to build the house of God. But then after about 12 or so years, the work was stopped. And they didn't go back to it. And they could say amongst themselves, well, brother, the reason that I've just got another loan to build another part, another four rooms on my house, is because, you know, the time is not right that we should build in the house of God. We know Jeremiah's prophecy, it says that there's got to be 70 years desolation on top of 70 years captivity.
And the desolation didn't begin until 586, when the house of God was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. So 70 years off 586 brings us down to 516 BC. So here they were, standing at 520 BC, and saying, well, we got 4 years to go before the house of God can be built. We are therefore justified in devoting our time and our energy and our money in building up our own houses. A little bit like saying in our heart, if not to our brethren, well, I don't think Christ is going to come for a while. And after all, Golden Grove doesn't really need my money, nor my energy. So what I'm going to do is sell up my 14-room home, which I built 4 years ago, and I'm going to build a new one. Blow the fact that it's going to cost me $6,000 for legals and agents' fees. Golden Grove doesn't need that. And after all, this plan to build the hall by the end of 1990 is rubbish. You know, it doesn't really matter if we don't build it. Christ is going to come eventually anyway. And we will find the justifications, brethren and sisters, to go on with our own building at the expense of the work of the truth. Now you take that out of the temporal realm that Brother Michael spoke about and put it into the spiritual realm. How many spiritual projects go begging in ecclesial life that you know of because we are too busy with our own things? How many people do you know that are languishing in the brotherhood, not just in this ecclesia but elsewhere, that are begging for help, but you and I do not get there to help them because we're too busy making money or building up our own things? Well, I'll tell you something, brothers and sisters, and I speak to myself as much as I speak to you. God does not look upon this any more differently today than he did then. There is absolutely no difference in his attitude towards what was happening then and what's happening today. And we have deceived ourselves to think otherwise, and we may as well pack ourselves up and go home. Because it's not so. What were they doing? Well, let's read on in the record. Verse 3. Then came the word of Yahweh by Haggai the prophet, saying, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses, and this house lie waste? Sealed houses. The word means panelled. You know, in those days, a panelled house was a palace. Today, of course, we've got to have every mod con, otherwise it's just not adequate. We've got to have our house done up in the brightest of things before we'll inhabit it. In those days, they used to live in mud and stone houses, and to panel them was to act like a king. But they had panelled houses. Well, the house of God was in ruins. That's what they were doing. So in verses 5 through to verse 11, the exhortation goes on. We'll consider that, brethren and sisters, in just a moment. I want to pause just for a second to quote some words from Brother Roberts, which I believe are very pointed in this regard. He speaks about spiritual stagnation, the kind of stagnation that overtakes individuals and ecclesias when we become Laodicean, interested in self. This is what he says. How natural it is for us to stagnate in spiritual things. How inevitably the mind of man, when let alone, seems to settle into self-consciousness and self-service only, and to become insensible to the existence and purposes and claims of God. How indisposed to self-sacrifice. How liable to live for this life. How unfitted to live as men called to the fellowship of God and of Christ. How incapable of seeing and feeling that we are nothing but shadows, fleeting across the surface of the troubled waters, and that God only is the eternal, enduring reality, working all things out of the counsel of his own will, and requiring of us a constant, hearty worship and a steady, unfaltering obedience to all his beautiful commandments. Very fitting words to touch upon the problem that had overtaken this people in the days of Haggai and Zechariah. They were spiritually stagnating because of self-interest and self-consciousness, and they lived comfortably in their panelled houses, and they were hungry and began to wonder why.
You see, brethren and sisters, when Haggai began to preach and to prophesy, he did so in the summer months, when it was hot, and when they had come to the end of a harvest period and had brought in very little. And at the forefront of their mind was the disaster that had overtaken their economy. They were being pinched by raging inflation and the shortage of essential goods. But they had their panelled houses. They had to send mum out to work at the expense of the children in order to keep pace with inflation, just to put food in their mouths. But they had their panelled houses. Wouldn't sacrifice that. You see, when you read on, it becomes very obvious that they were in the same situation that you and I are in. Not becoming any easier, is it, to maintain our living standards, the kind of standards we've got used to. It's becoming much more difficult. And as day passes day, as Brother Ron pointed out in one of the first studies for this year, more and more Christadelphians are capitulating to the God of this world and are sending their wives out to work at the expense of the children, in order that they might just keep up the standard and improve the standard of living that they've got. In what way is that different from what was happening here? Well, it's no different at all, because those same people don't turn up to some meetings. They find it difficult to get along to all that the ecclesia puts on. Of course they find it difficult. When are you going to do the washing? When are you going to do the ironing and all the things that need to be done around the home? You'll do it in the ecclesia's time. Oh, you'll still come along to the memorial meeting. We won't miss that, will we? But it's the other things, what we would classify the fringe activities of the ecclesia that suffer. You know, I've been through all this before, and we're still going through it, brethren and sisters, and we'll continue to go through it until Christ returns, because this is the character of the age. And it's only one here and one there that is prepared to say, whoa, this is enough. I don't want any more of this. I'm going to rechart my course. You won't get everybody to do that. Fortunately, they got everybody to do it in these days. Can be done, but I've never yet seen it done. So you see, the message is very pertinent for us. Let's not try and justify ourselves. Let's take the message to heart. Verse 5. Now therefore, thus saith Yahweh of armies, consider your ways. You know, we've often heard that statement used, haven't we? But it's a very poor translation. He is not saying, brethren and sisters, I want you to sit down and consider your course of life. Mind you, they had to do that, but that's not what he's saying. You'll notice the margin says, set your heart on your ways. That's a bit closer. But it's Rotherham who really hits the nail on the head in his translation when he says, set your heart upon your own experiences. That's what he wants them to consider. He wants them to sit down and to review the history of the last 2 years since the temple underwent a cessation of work. He wants them to sit down and just contemplate what has happened in their life in those 2 years, and to see whether or not they can detect the divine hand, see the invisible hand of God working in their affairs. And if they could see that, they could respond to it. And it was there. Because he then says, this is what's happened to you. This has been your experience, brethren. Verse 6, you have sown much. You're working longer hours. You're putting more seed in the ground. More effort is going in to keeping up your income. And you bring in little. Ye eat, but ye have not enough. Ye drink, but ye are not filled with drink. Ye clothe you, but there is none warm. You're cold in the winter. And he that earneth wages to put it into a bag with holes. Inflation is ripping away your earnings. Can't keep up with them. Every week the shopping bill goes up. The pressure comes on. I want more money, says Mum. I need more money just to feed us and the children. But the bank isn't paying me any more money. I'm sorry. You know what it's like, don't you? Maybe you haven't reached that point, brethren and sisters. Maybe none of us have reached that point. But everybody knows it's getting tighter. Why? This is why it happened in their days. Verse 7.
Thus saith Yahweh of armies, consider your way, set your heart upon your own experiences. And when you've seen what's happened, when you realise that you can put my work first at the expense of your own interests and you'll prosper, then I can do something with you. That's why he says in verse 8, go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith Yahweh. Doesn't matter how grand it is. I don't want a grand structure. I just want your faithful effort. I just want you to be diligent. I just want you to be here, building in my house, putting me first, putting my brethren, your brethren, my sons and daughters first. That's what he's saying to these people, brethren and sisters. I will take pleasure in that work, and I will be glorified in that work, saith Yahweh. Ye looked for much, verse 9, and lo, it came to little. And when ye brought it home, I did blow upon it. I scattered it. Why, saith Yahweh of hosts? Because of mine house that is waste. The ecclesia is lying waste. And ye run, every man unto his own house. It doesn't say you are going unto your own house. They're running. When it comes to our own things, brothers and sisters, you can get up early and you can put in almost any kind of effort. You'll run. When it comes to ecclesial work, sometimes it's a bit different. It's because of that attitude that Yahweh had stayed the heavens from over them, verse 10, and the earth from its fruit. That's why some of us go backwards. We've got our priorities wrong. And that's why some who appear to be in a much less advantageous position than ourselves, with only one going out to work, and the mother doing what she ought to be doing, looking after the children at home and making sure that there is a backstop for the children before and after school, that's why those sort of people sometimes prosper in life over the long term, if not the short term. Over the long term, they seem to prosper over and above those who ignore the work of the truth in order to pursue their own interest. It's a fact, brothers and sisters. I can nominate you 100 cases just from my memory where I've observed that fact. Do we want to learn the lesson? Well, look around and see what's happening. See what is going on in the brotherhood. See how much money we're spending on ourselves, on our new houses, etc. Where's it all coming from? Well, some of it's coming from robbery. And Malachi said that to this people a little bit later. He said, you've robbed God. Wherein have we robbed God? In that you give second best to his service. That's where you robbed him. In that you give your energy to make more money, and not to put that energy into his service. That's where it comes from. And you know, they might have even got the materials to panel their houses from the stockpile of the house of God itself. They might have even robbed God of the very materials of his house. So he says in verse 11, I called for a drought upon the land and upon the mountains and upon the corn and upon the new wine and upon the oil and upon that which the ground bringeth forth and upon men and upon cattle and upon all the labour of the hands, and you didn't prosper. But there was response to this message, brethren and sisters. They saw how the invisible had been working in their life. They understood that their disaster was the result of the divine hand, that he touched them, that he'd affected them, that he was doing it for their good. And the whole nation arose in verses 12 onwards, and they got up and did that work, as Ezra chapter 5 verses 1 and 2 record. And Yahweh, verse 14, stirred up the spirit of Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, governor of Judah, and the spirit of Joshua, the son of Jozadak, the high priest, and the spirit of all the remnant of the people. And they came and did work in the house of Yahweh of armies, their God. When? In the 24th day of the 6th month, in the 2nd year of Darius the king. And you'll notice that Haggai began prophesying in verse 1 in the first day of that same month. It took just over 3 weeks for that message to sink in. 3 weeks, and they changed their direction in life. If you're like me, brothers and sisters, it takes a lot of exhortations to knock you into shape. After a while, the message sinks in. But it's only going to make the difference in your life if you personally make the decision to change and to improve your performance in the truth. No good someone bludgeoning you to do that. You've got to make that decision. It took them 3 weeks to make it, individually and collectively. And they got up and did something about the work. Well, brothers and sisters, we need to go back now to Ezra chapter 5. In Ezra 5, verses 1 and 2, we read of what happened at the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah. Then the prophets, Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Now Haggai, of course, began before Zechariah. He appears to have been the older man of the two, and he's called a prophet, you'll notice. In fact, 7 times when his name is mentioned, the phrase "the prophet" is appended. Zechariah, on the other hand, is called the son of Iddo. He's not called the prophet, although, of course, the first phrase of the verse says that he was a prophet. Then the prophets, Haggai the prophet, and Zechariah the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews. It would appear to me as though Haggai was in fact known as a prophet, but that Zechariah was a priest, the son of Iddo, who was a priest. In fact, of course, as you can see from the notes that we've given you, if you've kept them for tonight, he was not the son of Iddo, but the grandson of Iddo. Zechariah's father's name was Berechiah. And when you put the names of those 3 men, Zechariah, his father Berechiah, and his grandfather Iddo together, a story is told. A story of the times. Zechariah means Yah hath remembered. Berechiah means Yahweh hath blessed. And Iddo means at the appointed time. So Yahweh had remembered them, brethren and sisters, because they had turned unto him with a fullness of heart. And he had blessed them at the appointed time in 2 ways. By clearing the way for the temple to be built, and by providing them some time later the blessings that they needed to pursue that work. And that's what happens in life when you get your priorities straight. When you put God first, brethren and sisters, he will look after the things of this life. But we don't all believe that. We say it, but we don't all believe that. Do we? It takes a while to come to believe that, and I have been talking with 1 or 2 in recent times who find it difficult to wrestle with that proposition and to fully commit themselves into the hands of their God. We've got to try and come to that point. It wouldn't be here in the record, brothers and sisters, if it wasn't difficult. If it was easy, God wouldn't worry about the exhortation. It's not easy to commit yourself absolutely into his hands. I like the choice of words in the opening prayer this evening, that we are totally dependent upon our God. Are we? Well, this is the test of the times in which we live. And so we read at verse 2, "Then rose up Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel and Joshua the son of Jozadak and began to build the house of God which is at Jerusalem. And with them were the prophets of God helping them." So there are 4 prominent men. There is Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai perhaps being the older man, the prophet. Zechariah being the younger priest. Joined with Zerubbabel the governor, the official ruler of the Jews, and the high priest, the religious representative of the Jews. Those were the 4 men who gave the example and got up and began to work. And their example encouraged the people to get down to the work of building the house of God. Brethren and sisters, need we say that the most powerful influence in ecclesial life is not necessarily the volume of words that may proceed from the platform. It is the power of a solid and consistent example which may back up the words that are spoken. That is the most influential force in ecclesial life. And the prophets of God, Haggai and Zechariah, were in there doing the work along with the rest, as were the governor, who could have sat back, and the high priest, who could have argued the necessity of keeping his garments clean. But he didn't. So in verses 3 to 5 we have the opposition arising again in the form of the Persian authorities in the land. Tatnai and Shethar-Boznai and their companions came along and they asked the question, who hath commanded you to build up this wall? Because they had a decree from Gamades to say, don't build it. Verse 4 is perhaps poorly translated. The Septuagint version has, not as the AV, then said we unto them, but then they, that is these Persians, spake thus to them. That's proven perhaps by verse 10, which records what actually happened. The letter is written in this way. We asked their names also to certify thee, that we might write the names of the men that were the chief of them. So they asked them for their names. Then verse 5 tells us that though the opposition had arisen again, the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease till the matter came to Darius, and then they returned answer by letter concerning this matter. The eye of their God was upon them, brethren and sisters. What does that mean? Well, we know such well-known passages as 2 Chronicles 16, verse 9, when Hanani the prophet came to King Asa of Judah and said to him, let the eyes of Yahweh run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is upright toward him. The eye of God, of course, is a way of speaking of angelic supervision of the saints and of nations. It's a way of speaking of Yahweh's eyes, his angels, who go throughout all the earth doing his bidding as ministers to those who are heirs of salvation. Now we can prove that by a series of psalms. We'll just quickly go through these psalms. Psalms 32, 33 and 34 are very suggestive as to what the eye of God represents as a symbol. The eye, of course, as we know, is the vehicle through which light enters the body. The Lord said the eye is the light of the body. And therefore the eye becomes a symbol of intelligence. The angels, brethren and sisters, are spiritual intelligences. They are an expression of the mind of God and his power sent forth to accomplish his work. He made his ministers spirits. He made them a flaming fire, says the psalm. So when you come to Psalms 32, 33 and 34, there seems to be a link between those psalms in this matter at least. In verse 8 of Psalm 32 we read, I will instruct thee and teach thee in the way which thou shalt go. I will guide thee with mine eye. Have a look at the margin. I will counsel thee, mine eye shall be upon thee. So the psalmist is told by God that his eye, Yahweh's eye, would be upon him. Psalm 33 verse 18 says this. 33 verse 18. Behold, the eye of Yahweh is upon them that fear him, upon them that hope in his mercy. And we're not told what that eye is. In Psalm 34 and verse 15 we read this. The eyes of Yahweh are upon the righteous and his ears are open unto their cry. But you see, in Psalm 34 we are told what the eyes of Yahweh are. We're only going to read verse 7, don't we? That well-known passage. In verse 7 of Psalm 34 we read, the angel of Yahweh encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. So by putting together those references in those three psalms, we can see that the eye of God is a reference to his angels who come forth from his presence as the expression of his intelligence, that they might not only see, but that they might act on behalf of those who are heirs of salvation. Now that's what this passage means here in Ezra 5 verse 5. If we needed any support for that, we could go to the book of Zechariah. Zechariah chapter 3 and 4 makes this very, very clear indeed. For those of you who were here a couple of classes ago, you will remember this transparency in which we endeavoured to set out the scene of Zechariah chapter 3. We'll read just the first four verses of Zechariah 3. Apologise for those who have been in the Zechariah class at Enfield. This will be a little bit of repetition. This, Joshua, a brand plucked out of the fire of Babylon. Now Joshua was clothed with filthy garments because he was there in the work with all the rest of the people, as Ezra 5 verse 2 says. He was clothed with soiled garments, and he stood before the angel, that is, Michael the archangel. And he, the angel, answered and spake unto those that stood before him. So here's our scene. You've got Joshua, the high priest. You've got the Samaritans over here, the Satan. You've got Joshua standing before Michael, the archangel. And there are angels in verse 4 that are standing before him. So here they are. What are they there for? They're there to accomplish the work. And the work in hand is the building up of that house, as well as the spiritual house of Israel. And Yahweh had sent forth Michael to oversee that work and to ensure that the angels did exactly what was necessary to complete that work, part of which was to ensure that a king came to the throne of Persia who would be friendly to their cause, who would reconfirm the decree of Cyrus. Part of that work, brethren and sisters, was to ensure that the opposition, the Samaritans and others, were kept at bay. And that was all done. It was a mountain of opposition, but it was removed, as chapter 4 says, verse 7. The mountain, the great mountain that was before Zerubbabel, would be made like a plain through the work of the angels. Now they're spoken of again in Zechariah chapter 3 and verse 9. For behold, he says, the stone that I have laid before Joshua, which Zerubbabel laid with his own hands, before Joshua the high priest, upon that stone, he said, shall be seven eyes. Now that word upon there in the Hebrew is the word al, A-L. You've heard, all heard of L-L airlines. Well, the word al means to be above, to be in the air. And therefore, what it's talking about is that there are angels there who are superintending this work. And the work was symbolised by the laying of a foundation stone, which of course obviously represents in the spiritual house our Lord Jesus Christ himself as the chief cornerstone. And so here we have the angels overshadowing that work, and their eye was upon it. And they're spoken of again in chapter 4 and verse 10, at the end of that verse, where a new sentence should begin with the word these, cross out the word with, put a full stop after the word Zerubbabel, and read the sentence at the end of the verse like this: these seven, they are the eyes of Yahweh which run to and fro through the whole earth. These seven is a reference to the manifestation of Yahweh's spirit. He made his angels spirits or intelligences, and he sent them forth as his eyes that they might overshadow his work of building up his house. So that's what it means, brothers and sisters, when the eye of their God was upon them. Let us now quickly go back to Ezra chapter 5. Ezra 5, of course, concludes, as we said, with a letter that was sent by Tatnai, the governor, and his companions to Darius Hystaspes. They were not to know that he would reply in the way he did. Just one point out of that letter. That occurs in verse 11. This is how it was reported in their letter. They asked their names in verse 10. And thus they returned us answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and build the house that was builded these many years ago, which a great king of Israel builded and set up. You know, the other day when we were up the block working on the foundation, brothers and sisters, a man came in asking directions for the local area, and he asked, obviously he was a bit bemused at all these pen pushers and other odd assortment of labourers working on a project that looked like it needed some expertise. And he said, is this community work, is it? You know what we said to him? We said, yes. You know what we should have said to him, don't you? We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and build the house that was builded these many years ago. See, I'm like that at work too. Someone says to me, what are you going away for? What's this trip away overseas for? Or whatever else it might be. I'm always dodging. I pick my person. If I think that I can say plainly to the person involved, well, you know I'm a Christadelphian and I'm off over somewhere to speak at a Bible school or whatever, I'll say it. But I won't say it to everybody. I know what it's like to be slightly embarrassed about coming into the open That's the lesson of verse 11, isn't it? You see, when the spirit of that nation was revived and they were all there building in that house, it wouldn't have mattered if the whole Persian army had come against them and said, "What are you doing here and who are you?" They would have all got up and said, "We are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and we're building his house, and his eye is upon us, and it won't matter what you do, you won't be able to stop it." We're not quite as bold as that, are we? We need to cultivate that, brothers and sisters. But you never will until you can make the invisible a reality. Well, let's go to chapter 6. Darius the king made a decree, verse 1, and search was made in the house of the rolls where the treasures were laid up in Babylon, and there was found at Akmetha, which is actually Ecbatana, you'll see that in the margin, the summer palace of the Persian kings. They used to try and get up into the, towards the mountains, away from the heat of the summer, which was of course very intense on the plain in Babylon and at Susa. So they chose Ecbatana, which was a splendid, a glorious capital of the Persian kings. And it was perhaps there that Cyrus had stored his decree, because that's where they found a roll. And therein was written the words of that decree, which we won't follow through now. We've done a little bit of that before. But you can go through that yourself, brothers and sisters, and you'll find that all he does here is he repeats the decree of Cyrus and he firms it up. He tells them at the end of verse 6, "You people that are there, that are my officials on that side of the river, be ye far from thence." That is, you remain aloof from interference. "Let the work of this house," verse 7, "alone. Let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place. Moreover, I make a decree." And so he adds to that decree of Cyrus, and he says things like this, that they were to be given their expenses out of the resources of the king and out of his tribute, that they were to be given the offerings that they were to make to their God, that their worship might be established, and that the prayers might be made for the king in verse 10, and for his sons in verse 11. The threat is made. "I have made a decree that whosoever shall alter this word, let timber be pulled down from his house, and being set up, let him be hanged thereon, and let his house be made a dunghill for this. And the God that hath caused his name to dwell there, destroy all kings and people that shall not put their hand, that shall put their hand to alter and to destroy this house of God, which is at Jerusalem." Now you really couldn't get a much better decree than that, could you? You couldn't ask for any better than that. And that's how things work out in life. If you just trust in your God, they work out in the most remarkable way. And if you sat down for 50 years and tried to write out in your wildest dreams what would happen, you would never, ever arrive at what actually does happen in the end. Ever found that? That comes from putting your trust in God and getting your priorities straight. You might say to me, brethren, young brethren especially, you might say to me, "I need to have a degree to get on in life. I need to be capable of floating around a piece of paper and saying, look, I'm qualified at this or qualified at that." I'll tell you something, you don't need it. And there are some cases in this meeting that prove to you, you do not need it if you put your trust in God. But you've got to have faith. It's pretty hard in a modern world that's telling you can't get on unless you've got this or got that. Well, it's not right. And they learnt that lesson the hard way, by severe rebuke and by deprivation, watching their children grow thinner as the days and the months went by because they couldn't feed them. They learnt that lesson that way until they got so thin that they could set their heart upon their experiences and say, "We're going the wrong way." Well, we come down to verse 13. Tatnai, the governor on this side of the river, and Shethar Bosnai and their companions, according to that which Darius the king had sent, so did they speedily. Of course they did. Their lives were at stake. And the elders of the Jews built it, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. See, same description. Zechariah the younger man, the priest. And they built it and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. The word "and" Artaxerxes should read "even Artaxerxes, king of Persia." Because, you see, Darius and Artaxerxes are both titles. It was Darius Hystaspes who issued the decree which saw that temple completed, and he was also known in history as Artaxerxes, which means a powerful king. So, through the work of Cyrus and of Darius, with the eye of God overshadowing those two monarchs, this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, the 12th month, which was in the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king, in the year 516. 4 years, 6 months and 2 days from Haggai chapter 1 verses 12 to 15, the 24th day of the first month of the second year of Darius. That's how long it took them to build that house, and they were going flat out for all that time. So we read in verses 16 to 18 that they kept the dedication of that house. Verse 16 reads, "And the children of Israel, the priests, the Levites, the rest of the children of the captivity, kept the dedication of this house of God with joy." The word means rejoicing. Of course they would rejoice. We'll see how that rejoicing was manifested in a moment. "And they offered the dedication of this house of God in 100 bullocks, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and for a sin offering for all Israel, 12 he-goats, according to the number of the tribes of Israel. And they set the priests in their divisions and the Levites in their courses for the service of God, which is at Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses." So they organised everything and they held a dedication in that 12th month of the year 516. And fast coming up upon them, of course, was the 14th day of the first month of the next year. Only now 2 weeks away, or 2 or 3 weeks away. So we read in verses 19 to 22 that they kept the Passover with great rejoicing. And the priests and the Levites, verse 20, were purified together. And we might just make the point, brethren and sisters, at this point in the record, from verse 19 onwards, the record reverts to Hebrew from Chaldee. It began in Chaldee, way back here in chapter 4 somewhere, where the letter began. The record turns from Hebrew to Chaldee. Now we get to chapter 6, verse 19, and it reverts to Hebrew again, because you see, there was deliverance from the bondage of the monarch of Persia. His decree that was written in Chaldee was overturned. And now the Passover, which spoke of deliverance from bondage, could be kept in the true spirit. They'd been freed from the control of the monarch. And so we read in verse 21 that the children of Israel, which were come again of the captivity, and all such as had separated themselves unto them from the filthiness of the heathen of the land, to seek Yahweh God of Israel, did eat. There was fellowship upon the basis of separation from the world. And they came together and they kept the feast in verse 22 of unleavened bread 7 days. There was no corruption in their midst. With joy. For Yahweh had made them joyful and turned the heart of the king of Assyria, or Darius Hystaspes, who was really king of Persia, unto them to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. So that work was complete. Do you know what, brothers and sisters? The record of Ezra, though it endeavours to paint for us a graphic picture of the rejoicing of that time, doesn't capture, really, the true spirit of that people. You remember when they began to build? You remember way back here in the year 536? And then 535, when the foundation was laid, that the ancient men in that house had wept bitterly, and there was a competition between the weepers and those who were rejoicing and crying out for their joy and pleasure at laying the foundation. And as the sound of one rose, the sound of the other rose in competition. You remember that? The scene at the laying of the foundation was one of division. They were not united. They gave vent to their feelings. And the people couldn't tell whether it was joy or whether it was wailing. But not so at the end. And neither will it be so at the end of our building work either. When the end of our building work comes, brethren and sisters, whether that be the Golden Grove Hall, which of course is a very minor building work as far as God is concerned, when that work ends, we will rejoice. But when the work of building the spiritual house ends, and the final stone is put in place in that house, there will be a rejoicing such as we have never seen, and which we could not contemplate. And it is portrayed for us in the 4th chapter of Zechariah, where we shall end our class this evening. Think about this for those who are described in verse 10 of Zechariah 4 as having despised the day of small things when the foundation was laid. Listen to Brother Roberts again when he wrote, "Are you dissatisfied with the smallness of your sphere and the limited nature of the service you can render? Be comforted by the thought that small things are often very important, that large ways might not be so useful in your particular case, and that it is possible for you in a small sphere to do what is, after all, the utmost a man can do in any sphere, and that is to faithfully make the very best use of the opportunity God gives, knowing that the small will be accepted equally with the great at the hands of him with whom it is accepted according to what a man hath, and not according to that he hath not. It will be helpful too to remember," he says, "that it is the faithful filling of a small place that is always exhibited to us in the Lord's teaching as the ground of exhortation to great things that is coming." End of quote. Very sound and encouraging words. There were men there who despised the day of small things because the temple was nowhere near as grand as the one they had known. But those same men, many of them perhaps still alive, would have rejoiced with everybody else in the day when Zerubbabel brought forth the last stone, the headstone, and placed it in that temple, and the work was complete. And we read of what he did in verses 6 and 7 of Zechariah chapter 4. We'll read verse 7 first of all. "Who art thou, O great mountain of opposition? Before Zerubbabel thou shalt become a plain. And he shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings, crying, Grace, grace unto it." That, brethren and sisters, describes the act of the governor in bringing forth that headstone. Now the headstone, of course, was the final stone that went in that building. It wasn't complete till that headstone was placed there at the top of that building, quite distinct from the cornerstone which they used in the foundation, against which all the other stones of the building were lined up. This was the last stone. Alright? Verse 6 says, "This is the word of Yahweh to Zerubbabel, saying, Not by might nor by power, that is, not by human strength nor by the power of armies, but by my spirit, saith Yahweh of armies, this work will be complete." And so it will be very shortly. And there will be, as this chapter here describes, an illuminated earth because of a great community of people who constitute the lampstand and the olive trees who feed that lampstand through the golden bowl. It is a representation of the kingdom age of Jew and Gentile drawn into the hope of Israel and feeding oil into that lamp. The lamp being Christ and his brethren who display the light of God throughout the whole earth. That's the scene depicted by Zechariah 4. It's going to come to pass with the power of God's Spirit. And when we see that work complete, brethren and sisters, when we stand in the temple of our God, which our hands, at least our voices, will be used to build as we direct the builders of that house, when we stand there at the completion of that work, when the earth is subdued before our Lord Jesus Christ and all peoples understand and know the truth and have come up to see the inauguration of that house, and we see the Lord coming from the east to enter in as the glory of Yahweh into that house, maybe perhaps coming with him into that house, we are going to witness a scene something like this. We're going to hear thunderous shouts emanating from the throats of every living soul standing in that building. And those shouts will echo down through 1,000 years until finally, when the work is utterly complete, at the end of 1,000 years, those same shouts will emanate from immortal throats. You see, when we come to the end of verse 7, it says, "He shall bring forth the headstone thereof with shoutings." The word shouting doesn't just mean to shout. It means to clap like thunder. It actually means to clamour. To make a clamorous noise. It's the kind of shout that is it's spontaneous. It's not the sort of shout that one would just raise for the sake of making a noise. This bursts out of people. What do they shout? Grace, grace unto it. That word grace is elsewhere rendered favour and beauty, and Rotherham renders it beautiful beautiful. Can you imagine yourself being in that crowd, brothers and sisters? And we will be there if we put God's house first and not our own. Can you imagine standing there and seeing that work being brought to completion? And having come from your throat, from the very being, the words described here, can you imagine that? And you see the Lord Jesus Christ coming into that house? What will you say? Beautiful, beautiful!
I can see them on that day when Zerubbabel brought forth that headstone and popped it into that building. And even the old men that despised the day of small things couldn't help themselves on that day. And the younger men and women who'd got their perspectives wrong, got their priorities wrong, couldn't help themselves on that day. You see, when we get to the end, we're going to see everything in true perspective, aren't we? We really are going to see what's beautiful. We need to sort that out, brothers and sisters, today.